Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent investment performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. If you don't believe it or don't get it, I don't have the time to try to convince you. Sorry. Now, that quotation is attributed to Satoshi Nakamoto, the founder of Bitcoin. Well, today we have the time, and we have someone unusually well-placed to explain what's going on in the world of blockchain and cryptocurrencies. Not surprisingly, he's our youngest guest so far, a digital native. So to talk about blockchain, the technology, its potential impact in the world of cryptocurrencies, I'm delighted to have the co-founder of Blockchain.com, the world's leading platform for digital assets. So Nick Carey, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon. So excited to be here today.
Well, Nick, a lot of this is new to me, and my research has only enlightened me to a certain degree, perhaps less than I hoped. Let's just take a step back. I understand you're from Colorado and you're trilingual. Shine some light on that.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Colorado. My mother is French, and my father spent the majority of his adult life down in Patagonia in South America. And so I grew up with a fairly global perspective. My mom was a civil servant, and my dad was an educator. And traveling was something we were always doing. And I learned very early on some of the challenges that came with moving money around the world. Also, my grandfather worked as a broker in the stock market, and I was always watching him look at the papers and look at the little numbers the following day at what had happened in the markets. I was quite curious what he was studying and all those things. So I think from an early age, I found an appreciation for how people think about money. And I think that's actually probably what drew me to the whole space eventually. I started as an entrepreneur. Actually, my first career was really as a teacher in India after graduating from university. And then I had an opportunity to join as a founding partner of a small technology startup. We built a customer relationship management application called Pipeline CRM. I was the first employee there. I was paired with a developer, and I got to study firsthand how companies manage their sales processes. And when a CEO or a head of business development walks you through how they cultivate clients, how they think about taking care of their clients, and how they make money, you really get an exceptional diagnosis of how companies run. And so that experience was extremely formidable for me. And then in 2013, I had the opportunity to move to the UK, which I was able to do thanks to my French passport. That type of global mobility was extremely important for our early foundation as we were trying to pull talent together from around the world to concentrate on building blockchain.com.
Well, Nick, thank you very much. You've jumped slightly further than I want at this stage, because you told me that at the age of 16, you were already buying and building and selling websites. So just tell me, what was that motivation?
Yeah, I think I've always had a bit of an entrepreneurial tickle. One of the first questions I love to ask everybody is, how did you earn your first buck? And so I'll answer that question, and then I'd like to hear you answer it. But I actually earned my first buck by clamming on the Long Island Sound. So I used to go out with my flippers and my mask, and I would unearth clams, and I would sell them to the neighbors that lived around my grandmother's house. And I was really obsessed with getting a boombox. When I was in the early 90s, getting a boombox as a young man was like a real status symbol. I wanted to be able to play music for my friends. And so that summer, I collected lots of clams. I sold lots of clams. And I was able to buy myself my first boombox. And that's how I basically began my career in entrepreneurship. I made flyers. They were quite lousy, but I earned enough money to achieve my goal. And that sort of, I think, triggered that growing up with the internet, I was fortunate enough to have parents that saw the value in getting a PC for the home. And I know this sounds silly today, but being able to play with that computer early on and watching the internet develop in front of my eyes, I was very curious to be able to creatively express myself. And one of the things we would do is build websites. There was a website called GeoCities, which was like an early MySpace or very early, almost Facebook type of platform where you could build a profile and you could put anything you wanted on that. Using those skills, though, my best friend and I started a website business when we were 16, and we sold websites to all of our friends' parents that were professionals. They were lawyers, they had small restaurants, and they wanted to be able to find new clients with people searching on the internet. And that's where I sort of really learned the basics of everything from contract writing to negotiating. And boy, did I make some really silly deals. We did a deal with this sandwich maker where we built him a website that allowed people to order stuff online. And this was in like 1998. So this was way before Deliveroo or anything like that. And I think we were the only two people that used it to order stuff on the internet. But the deal we did with this guy was unlimited free sandwiches for the rest of our lives. Unfortunately, the company went out of business like 5 or 6 years after that. And we also moved on. So it wasn't a great business deal, but at the time, when you think with your stomach first, before you learn that there are other motivations in life, that was a pretty good deal.
And not that anybody's really interested, but my first job was at Bristol Zoo. I come from Bristol, and it was cleaning loos and serving chips. So there you go.
See, but everyone starts off with learning how it all works and earning some income, and we all get better by practicing. And so I love hearing people's origin stories with that.
Well, before we talk about your company that you founded in 2013, let's talk about the blockchain technology. I've struggled to explain succinctly to my family exactly what it is and how it works. So lay it out for me.
So there are now professionals and consultants all over the world that make their careers out of explaining what this capability or this new technology is pioneering. And so I go back to the original proposal, which was outlaid by Satoshi Nakamoto. It's important to actually start at the beginning in this case. In 2008, there was a pseudonymous web developer and cryptocurrency advocate who proposed a kind of novel solution to a very long-term computer science problem, which was how do you get a computer system, a database, to stay in a state of agreement if you distribute it widely? And so you usually have what's called a consensus mechanism or maybe a governor that basically allocates decisions and then applies them downward to the network. So this person proposed an innovative solution to that using a proof of work algorithm. And this is a body of computer science that had been developed almost the last 20 years. So in a lot of the most cutting technologies, it takes decades for these things to actually build up and become commercially applicable. And whether that's in rocket sciences or life sciences or financial technologies, it's sort of a law of nature. So long story short, the best way to think about a blockchain is basically like a big spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet, something we might use at work every single day, except instead of there being one copy, there are many copies, almost like there are many copies in the cloud. And all of these spreadsheets are staying in a constant state of agreement or consensus about what was written into them. And so what you have here is a record-keeping system, almost like a large ledger of a history of all the things that had happened. And because the entire network has to agree about what's occurred simultaneously and almost instantly, you have essentially a global record-keeping system keep track of a state of truth. And what's going on with the Bitcoin blockchain, which was the first one, is it's basically just encoding a history of transactions. And it's actually quite simple in that way. All it does is record that something moved from one address to another. It writes that into the database, and then it distributes that globally around the world. So the best way to think about it, and from my perspective, is a big spreadsheet in the cloud that can encode precious information. And once it's written into that ledger, it can't be erased or modified. And so you've got a track record of things that have occurred with a high degree of certainty.
And so the next question must be, does it? And if so, why does it change the way things are done for business and other activities?
So one of the big challenges we've had, especially in the digital world, is corruptibility of data. And the other one is the replication of information. So Simon, if I take a picture of you skiing in the Alps, and then you share that photo with your son and he shares it with your mom, you now have multiple copies of this digital thing that happened. And it's very difficult to ascertain provenance, and you don't know which one's the original. And so we've had this data replication issue for a very long time, and it's made it very challenging to develop property rights in the digital era. What's pretty novel about the innovation of the blockchain is that we now have an immutable record-keeping system that you can record any type of property right into. It starts off with digital property rights, but we can begin to extrapolate that back into the atomic world. And so now, if you have basically a global worldwide fabric that wraps itself around the internet and is natively integrated into it, you can pioneer all kinds of interesting applications of that. The first application, though, as envisioned by the inventor of the Bitcoin network, was electronic peer-to-peer cash. Step one, let's see if we can build money for the internet. And if we can do that, maybe we can unlock other innovations. And that's basically what's been happening for the past decade. A lot of companies have been focused on basically testing out these capabilities and adding to them. The Bitcoin network was the first one. It basically outlaid a new format for how to develop money for the internet. Then there's a whole bunch of things that have happened since then. There are now thousands of blockchain-based asset protocols, precious information sharing systems, and much more that are being developed. And all of them are tinkering with some of the basic principles that the original blockchain built by Satoshi Nakamoto and then refactored and built on by many other open source developers. There are now many, many different projects that are all simultaneously trying to find product market fit.
So we're going to come to cryptos specifically a little later on. But in 2013, you co-found blockchain.com. And just for the record, well, you are now the world's leading platform for digital assets. And I see your financiers have been from more strategic ventures, Google Ventures, Lakestar, Richard Branson, and Bailey Gifford, I think recently placed $100 million with you in a refinancing or a financing. So why did you start the company?
So all companies have sort of interesting origin stories, and then they develop into something much bigger. So blockchain.com was actually started by a British developer and my friend, and I moved here to work on it with him. He was basically doing it all by himself. The original project was called blockchain.info. Now blockchain.info and blockchain.com are synonymous. But in the beginning, we were just interested in basically building a search engine for looking at that blockchain. We wanted to build tools that would enable regular people to study what was happening on this large transactional network. So the blockchain being this big spreadsheet in the cloud that's keeping track of all these transactions that are happening with a high degree of transparency. So we built tools that let you look at that and say, well, how many people are using it? How many transactions occurred in the last day, over the last week, over the last month? Is it speeding up? What's the distribution of value in this network? The one thing that all of the original founders of the company had was a mutual interest in statistics. My background in building technology companies, an interest in digital money, and then also in sort of the geopolitical implications of basically building a new form of money, an alternative financial system that would be natively integrated to the internet, caused me to become incredibly vocational about the work almost instantly. And so I moved to the UK in 2013 to join with my British business partner. We started building all kinds of tools and capabilities for the firm. And then in 2014, that's really where we put on our first muscle and we raised our first round of financing. And that was a Series A. We went on to raise a Series B a few years later with support from all of our internal investors, riding along investors like Google Ventures. And then in our Series C, you saw some of these macro crossover firms and large institutions also start to allocate into our company. And so blockchain.com today is now one of the world's leading crypto finance houses. And we sort of have two pieces of our business. We've got retail features that include a brokerage service. We have a full cryptocurrency exchange, allows people to buy and sell at volume. And then we have that data platform, which is really where it all started. We also have a sophisticated global institutional markets business, providing lending, custody, trading and bespoke structured deals for institutions. All of that's packaged together. And just yesterday, we passed the 75 million user mark on signups. So it's quite an exciting thing to be sharing it's been a long road, and we still feel like we're in the early innings of all of this. Despite the success that we've had to date, we are just barely scratching the surface, ultimately, of helping people reimagine their relationship with money. And so I'd love to spend a little more time talking a bit about that, because I do think it's worth digging into really what money is and the different ways that humans have evolved their understanding of money in the history of time. Because we have to face the reality of the type of economy we're participating in, and we need to have money that matches the needs of that era. I know that you're a gold bug because we talked a little bit about that, but I actually think there's a lot of reasons why people that are interested in hard money should at least study cryptocurrency and then form their own views on it. But there's a good starting point there to probably dig in a little bit.
So we're definitely going to talk about that. So I'm just going to hold you there, because you've had nearly a third of all Bitcoin transactions since you were established. And I think that you have some extraordinary number, like I read 65 million blockchain.com wallets. Just help me and just help my listeners understand, what is a blockchain.com wallet?
Our company name frequently gets confused with that core technology that a lot of people are excited about. Sometimes that happens in tech companies. If you remember, Microsoft actually stands for small software, and Facebook was actually a whole bunch of people's pictures of faces put on the internet. In our case, we named our company after what we thought was a clever innovation, and then the word also became the meme, kind of an entire technology group. So blockchain.com is a software business. We build a platform that allows institutions and regular consumers to gain access to this new financial system. And the best way to think about it really is, we have an iOS or Android or web wallet that you can sign up for. Anyone in the world can create a wallet with us. And that acts basically as your passport to all kinds of new financial services. You can send, receive, secure, trade, exchange, store, and custody digital forms of money, including just pounds, dollars, or cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, Ethereum, and many more. And so because we've been involved in this industry since the very beginning, we have a lot of the early vintages of users. And we also have a lot of the new ones that are discovering crypto for the first time. And just like any industry has waves where there's greater adoption that occurs over certain periods of time, the same is true in our industry. The economy at a macro level has eras where there's a lot of growth and then contraction. That also happens in cryptocurrency land. But the swings are very, very tight, and they happen extraordinarily quickly. So we've actually been through about five of these, what I would describe, adoption waves. And we are arguably in a break in the wave set this year. 2021 has been an extraordinary year for digital currency and digital assets generally. We're probably still in the middle of this newer adoption curve.
You've mentioned Bitcoin and Ethereum, and we know that there are a number of other protocols, but how should we think about the key protocols? What I really mean is the basic description and utility of the key top three, for example.
As we've mentioned, there are now thousands of different digital currencies or cryptocurrencies. The one that's most well-known and the oldest is the Bitcoin network, which still has about 65% of total market share in all digital assets. So it has a lot of brand recognition. It's deeply integrated into most of the original and newer service providers that are building tools for everything from institutions to businesses to retail customers. And Bitcoin is very specific in its use case. It has basically developed into an inflation hedge and a form of digital gold. And it was also working on being a peer-to-peer electronic form of cash. To date, that has not really been implemented at wide scale. There are a bunch of debates about why that is or not. But so far, primarily being used as a store of value for people that see it as one, a form of digital gold, and potentially for other reasons like an inflation hedge, which we can get into later. One that's certainly inspired a lot of interest over the past 5 years is the Ethereum protocol. Ethereum network is a bit more ambitious in its total set of use cases. And you may have heard people talk about things like smart contracts. If you think about a basic payment where I send you 10 pounds, Simon, because I lost a bet about who would win the Arsenal game, we sort of have an agreement. There was a bet, I lose the bet, and I send you some money. And that's pretty simple. A smart contract is a bit more sophisticated. In fact, it can be incredibly creative and have hundreds of variables all interacting with each other and then causing a value to be distributed against an agreement. And so the ambition of the Ethereum protocol is far greater in some ways than just an electronic payment. It includes an electronic agreement that executes over a worldwide computer that is also attached to one of these ledger systems. So imagine a world where we come up with a far more elaborate agreement where maybe you and I form some sort of digital company, and that digital company sells some goods on the internet. And anytime a payment is made to that company, a dividend is automatically paid out to all the shareholders of the operation. That's the kind of agreement you could create on the Ethereum protocol. And that's actually quite a basic one. There are far more sophisticated things being developed on that. And then there are dozens and dozens of other interesting use cases where you have fit-to-purpose technologies that are very high throughput, but only do one specific type of transaction, meaning they maybe only support a social media platform. There's an interesting one now called Clout, which is basically a decentralized Twitter where the content creators are actually rewarded for the amount of attention they get by a newly minted digital currency. So instead of advertisers being compensated in this world, the content creators are compensated for developing great content. So there's some really innovative new business models that align the value that the users are creating in these networks with essentially a distributed social currency or bank that is minting that value out to the people that are creating content on them. You can visit websites like blockchain.com or CoinMarketCap or CoinGecko that show the top assets, and they do move around quite a bit. And I will certainly not sugarcoat it. There's an extraordinary amount of volatility in some of these assets because there's a lot of speculation and arguably different levels of adoption. And so sometimes what are called the tokenomics are incredibly important to understand because the way these systems basically mint new assets and distribute them, it's extremely different. So it's worth spending a little time talking a bit about that because there's a good reason why the Bitcoin network has found strong fit as a store of value, whereas others have struggled. And in the Bitcoin protocol, the original network was encoded with some fixed variables. This is where we get into the monetary policy of these networks. In the case of Bitcoin, when the original network was composed and launched and distributed globally as a form of open source software, there were some rules that were embedded in it. And the only way to change those rules would be to take over the entire network, which would be extraordinarily difficult to achieve today. And I can talk a bit about the risk factors. But the key variables were that, number one, the total amount of digital currency would be fixed and there'd be a limited supply. And so in the case of Bitcoin, there will only ever be 21 million units of Bitcoin ever minted by this network and distributed to the validators, which perform important work on the network. And I'll explain that in a second. So you've got a fixed variable, 21 million. Now, because this system is based on the rules of mathematics, they also embedded some other useful tools in here. And one of them was that there would be divisibility of these units. So just like a pound can be divided into pence, a dollar into pennies, one Bitcoin can be divided into 8 decimal points, and the smallest unit of account is called a Satoshi. So 21 million by 8 decimal points creates a quadrillion units of account. So you have a lot of different units of account for this system, which is sufficient for now to perform a high degree of commerce globally. So how does this network work? Well, if you think this is interesting, then you can download the open source software for Bitcoin and literally run it on your computer. And by doing so, you are helping support the security of the network. And you are helping keep track of one copy of the blockchain. And so your computer is then burning energy to do this. And as a reward for keeping track of this transactional history of everyone's value, you are occasionally rewarded with newly minted Bitcoins. So a central bank like the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England prints money based on a commission or a reserve board or something like that at the direction of Congress or sometimes in emergency measures. And there's a whole process for how money flushes into the economy. In the digital currency space, the network itself has basically variables that determine how much money is either going to flush into the system. And there are varying ways of accommodating for that. In the Bitcoin case, there were only ever going to be 21, and new coins are minted every 10 minutes. And they go out to one of the Bitcoin miners, which can be anyone in the world, but now are primarily run by companies because there's so much value being minted that they've specialized very significantly. Every 4 years, the total supply actually decreases by 50%. This is a very important concept because in its design, Bitcoin has a deflationary currency schedule. So there is less and less and less of this currency coming into circulation every 4 years. And that arc will at some point cease. And it's predicted to be in the year 2144 or something like that.
So look, as we assess cryptocurrencies, some of the world's great investors, Alan Howard, Paul Tudor Jones, Stan Druckenmiller, have at some point owned Bitcoin or some of the other variables. And it was Stan Druckenmiller who said that crypto was a solution in search of a problem. My question is, what problem does it solve?
This is a great question. Let's talk a little bit about money. Most people spend their whole lives in pursuit of money to a certain degree. They want to get money so that they can invest in their family, so that they can maybe acquire things like a house or food for themselves, or maybe so that they can have experiences and go on holidays and things like that. But I believe that most people really don't have a strong understanding of why money has value. And this is pretty interesting because money is an old construct. It predates human writing. It's a prehistoric concept for humans. And we know this because we have found different artifacts in burial sites. We have found seashells that come from thousands of miles away from other places because human beings have tried different forms of money over our history. And so we used to live in caves. We invented the wheel. We paved roads. So we have created new forms of money to match an ever, I'd say, advancing economy. But we've also made some pretty terrible mistakes. One of the reasons is we've been experiencing essentially a technological inadequacy because we haven't been able to develop a sufficiently incorruptible language for money, which has caused all kinds of externalities. So I'll be specific here. We used to trade seashells, but we don't use those anymore because they're corruptible. There's a ton of them. They aren't rare. They don't have properties that really lend themselves to be a medium of exchange or a sufficient store of value. We used to use cigarettes. In World War II, you could bribe border guards. You could settle debts with your squad mates. We tried gold coins, and those worked for a pretty long time. Gold has a bunch of properties that make it a very interesting store of value and medium of exchange, which is why many empires relied on gold, sought gold to fill their coffers up and to expand their operations. Gold is rare, it's fungible, it's divisible, it has a limited and fixed supply, it's challenging to obtain, it's durable, but I would argue it's expensive to store, it's challenging to use in regular transactions to pay for things. And so we started to tokenize gold and we used paper money that would at one point in time reflect a claim on a specific amount of gold. And then, as we're aware, we broke the gold standards and we've been using an ever inflating amount of fiat currency now for a few decades. And so we're experiencing some interesting, what I would describe, externalities and arguably negative externalities due to this. Now, there are good reasons that can be argued by economists for why you would develop an inflationary currency. Maybe you want a credit-based economy because it allows people to get over their ski tips a little bit, buy stuff, and then pay for it later, and you have sort of a retail-driven consumer economy that grows for growth's sake. That kind of works okay, potentially, except you also get extraordinary amounts of debt. You develop completely unsustainable economic practices. And we're just now seeing the types of bubbles in almost every asset class, and now inflation. And so let's think a little bit about what we would want to have as a form of money if we could go back to ground zero. Let's observe the world we're living in today. We can start off by saying, right now, you're in a different country from me, and we are having a private conversation using digital capabilities that allow us to beam precious and interesting information to each other instantly over the internet. And especially over the last 18 months, in the context of a global pandemic, the need for many businesses to find new and innovative ways of working together in a world where trends toward digital are actually accelerating, it seems plausible to me that digital money would play an interesting role in some sort of future where more and more and more worldwide commerce is occurring globally in the digital means. And so there are a few other trends happening here. If we look at the tech companies over the last 10 years, they have far outpaced growth in the stock market against atomic industries. That's projected to accelerate. So by 2030, it's our thesis and one that's shared by some of our investors, and also that seems to be coming quite true, is that the internet itself will be the largest contributor globally to GDP. And so we want to build a financial system that's natively integrated to the internet so that people can seamlessly and instantly exchange wealth. And if we think back to what money is, again, money is just a social construct that enables people to exchange wealth. And we build different mechanisms for that. One of them was the modern financial system, or what I like to call TradFi, or traditional finance. Pioneered by the Medici family, you've got a bank. The bank has a ledger. The bank keeps track of that ledger and charges you rent for storing your value with them. Extrapolate that against all the different countries and all the systems that then need to negotiate, where everyone's checking each other's work to make sure that if you move money from Italy to Sardinia to Paris to London to New York, that those transactions are being encoded correctly in a variety of separate ledgers. Then you have this incredibly expensive, very brittle system that also relies on a very flawed model for bringing new value into it, which is the modern money engine. And we can talk a bit about how that works. But when the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England or the ECB coordinate global policy response to things like a pandemic, they tinker with the economics of our entire system. And so there are a bunch of arguments for why some cryptos, or specifically hard asset cryptos, are a response to this, but also tooling themselves for a world where we're all going to be operating predominantly over the internet. And so some of the benefits are anyone in the world can sign up for these systems. So basically, regardless of the circumstances of your birth, if you care about financial inclusion and you want to bring billions of people into the economic influence of the internet, then cryptocurrencies are a good way to increase the number of people that can participate in the economy. That's a big deal. The second, I would argue, is just simple transaction fees. Today, every time you swipe a credit card or even just store your money in a bank, you are losing value. The reason for that is because of negative interest rates. Even storing cash in your bank account isn't wise at the moment. But if you use a credit card or a debit card, every time you do that, you're paying Visa or MasterCard fees for doing so. It'd be nice if you didn't have to do that and the settlement happened with certainty almost instantly. That's true in cryptocurrency. It makes it faster for people to basically engage in commerce anywhere in the world. And then lastly, you have a completely different set of fundamentals that govern the economics of the system. One based on mathematics with predictability and an inflation schedule or a deflationary schedule that is highly transparent and there's no coercion going on or corruption in the currency supplies. There are other arguments to make too, but those are some of the ones that are inspiring new thinking, especially among, I would call, traditional financial professionals around what they're actually seeing in these protocols.
You actually encapsulated the argument for gold very well. There is always a debate around it, but the scarcity, not uniquely to gold, but the scarcity at a time of money creation, you know, is important. We all have read the histories of the Weimar Republic and Zimbabwe and others, and there's a dangerous comfort that this money creation that we've seen since the Great Financial Crisis, and actually slightly predating that, is all going to be controllable by central banks because they are, if not omnipotent, they're omniscient and they can manage it, and we'll see. But whilst gold is very clear in its limited supply, there are now over 5,000 cryptocurrencies. So how should we think about reconciling scarcity whilst there's proliferation?
Yeah, this is a good point. So just like gold is a very valuable mineral because of its properties, there are other minerals too. There's silver, there's lead, there's copper and all kinds of stuff. In cryptocurrency land, there's a lot of different projects. A lot of them are not worth very much or anything at all. And partially it's because of their security design. And it's also partially because of the total human contribution that is going into it. And so Bitcoin benefits from an enormous amount of support from open source programmers and developers that curate, cultivate, and improve this technological transactional fabric for the internet. It's scaling up as more and more users find it useful, and keeping up with that maintenance is a big deal. And so what we're experiencing now is network effect money. It's merging features from the atomic world, aka gold, blending them with technological capabilities, and then adding on top of that social norms and network effects. And so you're basically combining things that we have in our history found useful with capabilities that we've only recently unlocked. And so if you could have gold that would enable you to beam it and teleport it anywhere in the world instantly, basically for free, you would probably use that as a form of money. But we don't have a good way of doing that because gold is difficult to store. It's hard to trade with. If you'd want to send it from somewhere to somewhere else, you got to get guys in a big truck and guns to protect it on its journey. So we don't have an effective way of basically using gold as a form of money today. But if you were to give it capabilities, that's one of the things that the Bitcoin network has really nailed. The other networks, though, are trying to do a whole bunch of other things, especially in a world of essentially totally permissionless creativity. You have some really wild ideas. And so the example of the social network that has essentially decentralized itself and is now running, there's no CEO of Clout like there is a CEO of Twitter. And so if you think it's important for the internet to have a resilient forum where people can debate and discuss ideas without fear of censorship, then maybe using that type of platform would be useful to you. If you're an up-and-coming musician or artist, and you don't want the majority of your future royalties going to some agent or a large music house, there are now copyright programs where you actually load up the content that you create, your music, your writing, your art, anything, and you are instantly rewarded for the views that people give you on your content instead of having to go through these centralized old rent-seeking systems. So there's very powerful market forces that are aligning with these networks and are enabling totally new forms of value creation that wouldn't have been possible 10 or 15 years ago.
So while I understand your argument for the legitimization of these cryptocurrencies, do you worry about the volatility and that simply one tweet from Elon Musk can send gyrations through any number of these currencies, most particularly Bitcoin?
I do worry about the volatility because, unfortunately, humans have some native features in them that make them vulnerable to their worst natures. And so if you hear about an opportunity that sounds too good to be true, many people get involved or ensnarled in risk in ways that they shouldn't because they didn't do their homework. So in cryptocurrency land, what happens today is someone can basically launch a new digital currency and they can call it Future Coin or something like that. And if they find a venue to list it on, then people can buy and sell it. Now, if you were looking at the price of Bitcoin and you could say, well, that's really expensive today, maybe I'll buy this future coin is only pennies, I might buy some of that. But what you wouldn't realize as a retail consumer is that that network has no support from any developers, programmers, or a network of individuals maintaining verification nodes and all these things. So you would essentially be falling for a trap of a kind. And so for that reason, I think it's a little worrisome. But just like the first people that took a bet on Apple or Facebook or some of these other, any company, really, you have a view. And if that view is right, then you're compensated and rewarded for it. And that's been true in the cryptocurrency space. There are many early users and early investors in this industry that have made a lot of money, but a lot of them also recycled that money into building companies, just like we did, into investing in an ecology of services and support. And because we have a long-term perspective on tooling the internet with a way for anyone in the world to transfer value with one another, and that's basically what we're still working towards. And like I said, based on what's publicly available, there's somewhere between 150 to 200 million holders of cryptocurrency in the world today. So that's still a very small percentage of the worldwide population. We have a long way to go to increase the adoption of these capabilities and these assets. So in short, no one should ever invest in things they don't understand and they didn't do their homework in. In cryptocurrency land, just like in the penny or pink slip stock market, there's lots of scams. There are a lot of bad actors. If you're going to be serious about studying this space, you need to look at companies that are reputable, that have long track records of operating, that have strong governance structures, and that do a good job with customer support. And it's pretty easy to do that if you put the time in.
This adoption will require, of course, greater institutional support, and the institutional universe will have very clear requirements around due diligence. So just explain to me what's going on in terms of the infrastructure, custody and due diligence, and therefore the ability for institutions to get comfortable.
This has been probably the most important thing that's been happening in 2021 that is least reported on, but also because the institutions are the sort of slowest to move in this case. And so when we talk about institutions, we're talking about crossover funds, pension systems, sovereign wealth, even countries looking at how to adopt digital currencies, central bank digital currencies, or crypto assets as part of their balance sheet compositions. And behind the scenes, a lot is going on. But there's an interesting dynamic, which is for the first time in the modern economy, the institutions are sort of the last ones to take a bite at this apple. Now, they're still circulating this orchard, because there is so much going on in it. There are a couple of things to break down here. One is certainly on the counterparty side, the insurance side, and the custody bit. When institutions allocate funds, they are putting on a risk management hat that does not give them any leeway on the volatility or the risk. And so ensuring cryptocurrency has been one of the more challenging elements to navigate. There are regulated financial products that are being developed now for institutions that have all the same wrapping as the types of instruments that these institutions are used to investing in. So the type of governance they're expecting, the type of regulatory disclosures that they're expecting, regular reporting on these things. We're already seeing everybody from Goldman Sachs now offering digital currency products to their private wealth clients, to finally JP Morgan, who has been dramatically opposed and incredibly critical of digital currencies, coming out and saying they are building sales services for digital assets. Fidelity has done so. These are just a few of them, but what's going on in the background is that almost everyone is developing their strategy here. Some are partnering, some are acquiring, and some are building their own capabilities. And when they do that, they have to start at the very bottom, which is custody, security, then transactional capability, liquidity, provisioning, and all those other market infrastructure features that are necessary to offer oftentimes either bespoke or the highest margin offerings to their clients. It'd be worth mentioning too, though, that for the first time this year, we've seen a sovereign nation actually adopt at least Bitcoin as a legal form of tender, which is extraordinarily interesting. So El Salvador this year in their parliament and then passed by their president actually made it a national regulatory obligation for people to accept Bitcoin as an asset for any debt. And so it is now legal tender in El Salvador, and you are required to accept it, which is a very interesting development. We're not sure if we'll see more countries follow that path, but you've got institutions, countries, and now major corporations holding crypto on their balance sheet just as part of a broader risk management and balance sheet management strategy. And those companies are big ones. So Tesla, SpaceX, Michael Saylor's company are all holding large positions. For every company, by the way, that publicly says they're doing this, there are probably 10 that are not publicly disclosing their positions.
So Nick, that seems like a good place to pause the first part of this two-part conversation. You've given us some great insights into blockchain technology, Bitcoin, and the world of cryptos, your company, blockchain.com, and the emerging institutional interest in this space. In the next episode, we're going to discuss the debasement and future of money, digital transacting, inflation, crypto crime, China and its state to control digital currency, the issue of personal freedoms, and government regulation. So thank you for now.
Thank you, Simon. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.